This podcast contains informational material regarding sexual assault and rape. It may not be suitable for all listeners. One minute and 13 seconds. Most everyday activities take longer than that. Brushing your teeth, taking a restroom break, engaging in a small talk conversation, finishing a song on Spotify. Every single one of those everyday activities all take longer than the time it takes for another American to be sexually assaulted in the United States. Every 73 seconds. According to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, known as RAIN, this statistic equates the number of yearly sexual assault survivors to around 433,648 people per year. That number represents the United States alone. Hi, my name is Lexi Hargesheimer. I'm a senior in college at Appalachian State University, and I've made this podcast, paired with a research paper, that makes up my honors thesis exploring the role digital activism takes in fighting against rape culture on social media platforms. This podcast is constructed around three interviews I conducted myself, each providing a different angle of perspective and expertise regarding the discussion of anti-rape digital activism. As a broadcasting major with a minor in gender, women's, and sexuality studies, I believe it is my responsibility to explore how the media can be used to disrupt, rather than perpetuate, these toxic ideals that rape culture has ingrained into our society throughout history. First, let's meet our interviewees.
So my name is Amy Dellinger-Page, and I'm a professor of sociology and the undergraduate programs director for sociology. My background in terms of my bachelor's degree and my master's degree were both in psychology, and then I switched for my PhD and went into sociology, specifically criminology and gender and sexualities. And all of that work was geared toward understanding sexual violence. Most of my master's work and part of my PhD work was centered around offenders. So I worked probation, I worked in a juvenile detention facility, I worked in a women's prison. I was set up to work in a men's prison with 625 sex offenders, but instead got an internship at the FBI in Quantico. So I worked instead with the behavioral science unit and specifically an instructor who taught National Academy, and they taught the interpersonal violence class. So really got to understand the crime of sexual violence and offending from a psychological and sociological viewpoint, but also from a law enforcement perspective. And most of my research is on police officer attitudes, policy work, things like that, how to make it better and how to better inform prevention work.
My name is Michael Ng. I am an assistant professor in the philosophy and religion department here at Appalachian State University. My PhD is in philosophy, and I specialize in philosophies of race, gender, and sexuality, as well as disability studies. In my work, I focus on the ways that people become subjects within a structure, within institutions, and the way institutions carry on specific kinds of ideologies and ways of thinking or cultural logics, such as patriarchy.
My name is Sarah Crouch, and I'm the outreach coordinator for OASIS. I handle all of our social media, Facebook and Instagram. I work to educate our community. And I would say that social media right now with OASIS plays quite a role because I've chosen to take it that way. In the past, we've not focused so much on social media, but I found that, especially as we're living in a college town in Boone, and even in our work in Avery County where they have Lise McRae, I found that that's a really good way to connect with people who are students and people who are of the millennial or even younger generation. So I've chosen to focus a lot on social media, and I think that it's really allowed us to get our services out there and educate, you know, so I can post little graphics on Instagram that talk about what's a healthy relationship, what is rape culture, what is sexual violence, and like, what does that even mean? How do we conceptualize it? And that immediately, you know, educates at least however many people see us, you know, post that. And so for me, I like it to be the role of education. And then I also think it's an opportunity to provide information about OASIS services specifically and events that we host. And it also allows us to have a platform to speak out about relevant social justice issues. I mean, I think that We've done that a little bit with our social media platforms. We've also done that a little bit with our digital newsletters. So that shift into just clickable content has been really helpful when it comes to educating specifically millennials and the younger generation. My educational background is that I have a bachelor's in English literature from the University of Kentucky. A lot of the literature that we learned about was related to sexual violence, especially when I took things like women's lit, black women's lit. A lot of, you know, pieces of art are created from that trauma background, from sexual violence or intimate partner violence. After my undergraduate degree, I moved to Appalachian State and I pursued a master's in public administration with a focus in nonprofit management. And that led me to OASIS.
OASIS stands for Opposing Abuse with Service, Information, and Shelter. It is a dual nonprofit organization located in Boone, North Carolina that serves survivors of both sexual and domestic abuse in Watauga and Avery counties.
The mission of OASIS is to end domestic and sexual violence in Watauga and Avery counties. And so we do that in a variety of different ways, but mostly we provide direct client services and advocacy for clients.
Their website, oasisinc.org, gives a list of the specific client services they offer, all of which are free, confidential, and offered in English and in Spanish. These include a 24-hour crisis hotline, temporary shelter, legal and medical advocacy, case management, survivor support groups, information and referrals to other services, and short-term crisis counseling.
As a person who works at OASIS, we all undergo the same types of training. So in my first month or so here, I learned about, you know, the cycle of violence when it comes to intimate partner violence. I learned about sexual violence and the neurobiology of trauma that happens afterwards. And I learned a lot about rape culture. I learned a lot about forensic evidence collection kits, the criminal and civil processing that goes along with sexual violence and things like that. So pieces of my educational background have allowed me to be able to speak on this. My personal background being a woman in the culture that we live in today has allowed me to speak on this, but mostly my work at OASIS and the education that they ensure that we do here so that we can be trauma-informed mostly gives me the right to speak on this.
OASIS is only one example of the service organizations that began to pop up in the 60s and 70s after second-wave feminists identified just how big of a problem sexual assault was.
Rape culture kind of as a term came around in the 1970s.
In fact, the term was coined by an activist named Susan Griffin, who wrote about how rape culture is a type of terrorism, which severely limits an individual's freedom. It was later that other feminist writers added on to Griffin's definition and began conversations about the many different facets that make up a rape culture.
Objectifying women, infantilizing adult women, sexualizing younger girls. It's in the language that we use.
Victim blaming, sexual objectification, trivializing rape or making it a joke, the denial of the prevalence of sexual violence, and refusing to acknowledge the harm that's caused by sexual violence.
Part of refusing to acknowledge the harm comes from the widespread belief of rape myths. These are false preconceived notions that one internalizes about rape due to societal perpetuation.
There's a pervasive thought that rape is really stranger rape, right? When we picture rape in our minds, it is a stranger jumping out of the bushes at night and attacking a virginal woman who incurs a lot of physical injuries and goes straight to the police to report. That definitely happens, but it's not the vast majority of what happens. And so it's thinking about rape only in those terms and discounting rape that doesn't look like that, which really is the vast majority of rape.
The way that I would define rape culture is just societal norms and expectations that allow sexual violence to happen, to thrive, and to go unchecked.
I think a lot of people talk about it as this ubiquitous thing, but it really is just a society like ours and like most Western patriarchal societies that view rape as not that bad.
Rape culture is a culture in which sexual violence is treated as if it's normal and victims are blamed.
It's a lot of victim blaming as well. So placing the onus on potential victims to alter their behavior to somehow reduce the risk of their assault versus focusing on what do offenders do or how should we talk to potential offenders about how not to offend.
What I understand to be the normalization of violence against women and this idea that women's bodies are material simply available for use.
It's devaluing women in the sense of their only real commodity is their sexuality.
One of the key texts that I teach in many of my courses, but certainly in my feminist philosophy course, is Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. Beauvoir reconstructs the way that the feminine gets equated with nature, the feminization of nature and the naturalization of the feminine that authorizes the masculine, that authorizes men to see women's bodies as material that they can use to construct culture as just a raw material to be used and used up and, of course, disposed when it's no longer useful. Any kind of subjectivity is an accident or it's being allowed in patriarchy. Patriarchy works against the possibility of feminine subjectivity. Feminine subjectivity is a threat to patriarchy. You know, we know that rape is not really about sex, it's about power and it's about domination and shame. And these are experiences that prevent someone from, or at least are severe obstacles to claiming a sense of self and a sense of subjectivity, in the sense of having autonomy, having freedom and a feeling of self-determination. It's not a coincidence that rape is used as a weapon in war, as a way to conquer a culture, because the logic relies on this idea that men within a culture see women as their property. And so if a kind of foreign force subjects their property to rape, it demoralizes the men. That's the message. So women are being used as a means to demoralize a population, but it relies on the logic of patriarchy and women as property.
It derives from the fact that rape began as a property crime, not as an individual level crime. And I think a lot of our rape myths and our ideas about rape still cling to some of those ideas. It's hard to erase those from the collective consciousness of our culture.
I understand rape culture and patriarchy to be the same thing. I don't make a distinction between the way that patriarchy shapes contemporary culture and the assumptions that are built into what we call rape culture. I don't think rape culture is outside of the university or even outside of philosophy. It is because patriarchy shapes the spaces that we're in, even the spaces that we might be in to critique patriarchy. It's the air. It's what we breathe. That's what's at stake.
And actually, yesterday I shared an infographic type thing to the Oasis Facebook, and it was two people, and one person is saying, "It's just a joke, you know, why do you care?" And the other person is saying, "Sexual violence exists on a pyramid, and your joke allows the violence against women to thrive." I thought that spoke volumes about how the things that we say and the things that we allow to go unchecked kind of serve as like really the foundation for intense forms of violence and even sometimes the murder of women to thrive.
Another important part of rape culture is toxic masculinity. If you've ever read or watched anything by Jackson Katz, you know what I'm talking about. Toxic masculinity is the ideal that our society encourages boys and men from a young age, that there is only one type of masculinity, and it is founded on the patriarchal idea that the masculine dominates the feminine. The author of a book called Asking for It, named Kate Harding, says in her book that, quote, "Every American boy is at risk of growing up to become a rapist."
As things stand right now, and as they have historically stood, the male gender is seen as superior.
When you're living in a larger social structure that privileges men as a group, not all men have that same access, but privileges men as a group, then in some ways all boys are at risk.
Violence against women, which sexual violence happens to people of all gender identities, but women especially, is seen as okay because we're inferior, right? For as long as that's, you know, being reinforced by society, then I believe it is true that every young boy has that possibility.
The message that is sent within patriarchy that women's bodies are simply there for male use or masculine use. I can see that that informs this idea that any boy can become a rapist.
I don't like using that phrase, though, so I don't wholly agree. I agree with the sentiment, but I think we have to be careful that we don't make it sound like masculinity in and of itself is bad.
I don't think that maleness is inherently the issue. It's that toxic masculinity. It's those societal functions that allow masculinity to be seen as superior. Everybody has something inside of them that could, if gone unchecked, lead to sexual violence or intimate partner violence. Unfortunately, the way that society is functioning right now is most often men who are the perpetrators of those forms of violence.
I think how we socialize and how we describe masculinity can be problematic when it's done in such a way that's very toxic and very narrowly focused. The majority of men do not fall into that category. It's a small group of men who really adhere to these toxic masculinity ideals. And so I think we do need to be mindful of how we talk about masculinity and that it's really plural because there are multiple masculinities. I think if we really want men to be engaged in that conversation, then we do have to be mindful of how we talk about it. We want men involved in the conversation. We want to have a better understanding of the complexities, the harms that they feel, the pressures that they feel, and that they experience. And I don't think it's fair to discount those.
Anti-rape traditional feminist activism began in the 1960s and 70s, when small group conversations between survivors led them to understand just how prevalent sexual assault was. This led to the development of a feminist consciousness. Sarah Ahmed, author of Living a Feminist Life, describes how a feminist consciousness is like finding like-minded friends through literature and conversation. In the 70s, this consciousness led to the first speakouts and the development of the country's first rape crisis center in Berkeley, California in 1971. It was the mid to late 70s when the first anti-rape national organizations were founded in the United States. The National Center for the Prevention and Control of Rape sprouted in 1975, followed by the National Coalition Against Sexual Assault in 1979. With the development of the internet, anti-rape activism then took a digital turn, leading to activists posting content like the picture of Meryl Streep yelling at the Oscars, paired with the encouraging caption to signal agreement, "Say it louder for the people in the back." Anti-rape activism turning digital also led to what has been called perhaps one of the most high-profile examples of digital feminist activism we have yet encountered. I'm talking about the Me Too movement.
So the Me Too movement began years ago, but sort of got a resurgence because Alyssa Milano tweeted hashtag Me Too.
Well, I know it became popularized around, I think it's 2017, with Alyssa Milano using the hashtag Me Too in response to the Harvey Weinstein allegations and scandals. But I also know it goes back to 2007, at least with Tarana Burke.
Me Too is actually founded by a black woman named Tarana Burke, and she founded it in 2006 or 2007. This idea of Me Too from Ms. Burke was founded because she had encountered a very young rape survivor and she didn't know what to say to her. And what she wanted to say is Me Too, like it happened to Me Too. So that idea of Me Too in that moment kind of came out of fostering empathy for survivors and empowering survivors through empathy and making it feel like you're not alone because you're not at all.
That phrase circulated among women of color, especially as a way to signal solidarity around sexual violence, experiences of sexual violence.
Oftentimes, after trauma, we feel very alone and we feel very shamed because of rape culture. And so Ms. Burke kind of identified Me Too as being an empowering moment of empathy for survivors. And so I think that there was some work done around that idea, but of course, we didn't know about it until 2017 when Alyssa Milano tweeted about the Harvey Weinstein case. And she said that something to the effect of, you know, if you've ever experienced sexual violence, use the hashtag Me Too. And it exploded. As of course it did, because sexual violence is so prevalent.
The idea behind it is to show how common, how frequent, how pervasive in all realms of everyday life the experience of sexual harassment, sexual violence, street harassment, just to show how pervasive it is.
Because of the power of social media and especially Twitter, other countries saw it and tweeted it. So that hashtag really took off, and now it's the Me Too movement, and we know it as such.
It's a kind of fraught history.
I think that it's really important that we honor the beginnings of it and to note that it wasn't started on Twitter. It wasn't started by Alyssa Milano.
One of the greatest benefits of a digital activist movement like Me Too is that it created an open platform for voices all around the world to join in and tell their stories. It's through the sharing of these voices that this kind of virtual solidarity and community was created.
It's important to keep in mind, as Lee Gilmore, who's a feminist theorist at Wellesley, has been working on issues of testimony for a long time. One of her more recent books that came out around 2017, Tainted Witness, focuses on this idea that women's voices and victims' voices in general get discounted already within patriarchy. The Me Too movement, it does, in a way, document a shift away from what Gilmore calls the he said, she said dichotomy or weapon that has been used within popular culture, but also legal discourse.
It's given voice to survivors who have been able to tell their stories on social media, sometimes more anonymously, sometimes fully owning it in ways that they never would have without Me Too. So I think in the sense of giving voice to something that sometimes people had never uttered to anyone, that now they uttered in this very public way, is healing in some ways for individuals.
So I think it also gives people who maybe previously wouldn't have had a voice suddenly. I remember being on social media during that time, and it was every single platform was #MeToo, #MeToo. And it was really shocking, in a way, to see so many survivors being so open. And it was really empowering. So that empowerment through empathy that was the original goal, I think was, at least for me, shined through for that.
One thing that the Me Too movement has helped make visible is that many forms of testimony within the Me Too movement take the form of women saying, the first time I was assaulted. So it's not just that women are assaulted, but that sexual assault, harassment, like this is part of what it means to be a woman within rape culture, within patriarchy, and that it's a repetition. It's a condition.
Social media has given way to, you know, an entirely new way of connecting with people.
Its popularization through social media kind of authorizes others to speak out and to find some kind of solidarity around these kinds of experiences.
And there's something about this collective experience that makes you feel like you're not alone. Even if you intellectually know it happens to other people, there's something about reading somebody else's experience that fully matches yours or mostly matches yours that is both discouraging in some ways, but also validating in many ways. And so I think in the sense that it provides that space and in the sense that it provides awareness, it's good.
I don't think that social media can be discounted in terms of its role in just distributing this idea. I do think that as a phenomenon, the way that these phrases as hashtags can capture some kind of feeling and some kind of moment.
I think there is something positive about sharing those experiences on social media, seeing other people's experiences, kind of realizing the extent, which is also depressing and outrageous in so many ways, but also validating.
I think it's important that something like Me Too can help identify a kind of community and therefore be a basis for solidarity. And I think that that's, in terms of activism, in terms of trying to bring about some kind of change within the social sphere, I think that's important.
A kind of community like that is reassuring and empowering for a lot of survivors. However, not all survivors feel as welcome or empowered.
I think one of the problems with Me Too is that it is largely a movement to give women voices to their experiences.
Notice I keep saying women. I feel like the Me Too movement was largely women survivors speaking out. And of course, not a lot of male survivors or even gender nonconforming people. I think that that speaks also to like the lack of reporting or the underreporting by male survivors and gender nonconforming survivors. But I do think that it was very women-centric, which is amazing, and we need movements like that. But we also know that women are not the only victims.
We live in a patriarchal society. It doesn't mean that men don't experience violence or aren't discriminated against, but it does mean that like the primary material, again, for patriarchy to establish itself and to maintain itself is the feminine. And so women-identified individuals, they are subject disproportionately to violence. But I think that goes along, you know, almost without saying, gender non-conforming individuals and trans individuals as well, because that's an implicit criticism of patriarchy to be non-gender conforming and trans.
Especially with the hashtag MeToo, we saw a lot of famous women first jump on that, you know, and so initially with the hashtag, it was mostly women, and I think that may have just continued, you know, that it's like, okay, well, this is mostly women that this has happened to. Statistically speaking, women are more likely to be victimized by this form of violence, but we know that's not like only the case.
In a lot of ways, it also discounts male victims and makes it much harder for them to come forward because of how we think about gender and sex and how those are intertwined. I want to say some men posted about their experiences and were kind of shut out of the conversation. And that's so harmful and problematic.
I mean, in the sense of non-gender conforming trans individuals and even masculine identified individuals who experience sexual violence and assault. I think that of course is important to realize that sexual violence is not exclusive to any one quote unquote type of person or one type of identity. I think if somebody is utilizing and identifying with that movement, that it has to be real. They have to be captured by it in order to identify.
I think that the hashtag MeToo movement wasn't purposefully exclusive of male survivors, gender nonconforming survivors, and things like that. But I do think that it is harder for people who are gender nonconforming or identify as male for those people to come forward.
Whether intentional or not, it marginalizes people who have experienced all of those things, who are male identified, who identify as non-binary, who identify as genderqueer, who identify as trans, who identify in a whole host of ways. We don't allow them in the space for Me Too, and I think that's a problem. I think we have to be more inclusive in how we talk about it and welcoming all experiences. I think that's the only way we're actually going to improve things.
While Me Too has become a gendered issue, it has also become racialized.
So that's been a criticism of the Me Too movement, that its popularization by figures such as Alyssa Milano. There are other white female celebrities who popularize it or help popularize it, that it also constitutes an erasure of women of color's experience with sexual violence.
It's also largely white, which isn't where it began. It's problematic. I think we just have to be mindful of it and continue to bring that into light and bring it into the conversation, because otherwise we're not really moving forward in any way.
People at the beginning of this were really frustrated. The people who knew that Tarana Burke was the true kind of creator of this movement were incredibly frustrated by the traction that the hashtag got, because it was, you know, Alyssa Milano, who I believe is a white woman, tweeting it, you know, so it got a lot of traction. And I think that a lot of people were frustrated by like, wow, why does it take this white woman tweeting about it to actually have our voices be heard.
These ideas that certain movements can constitute erasures of other kinds of histories, I think that needs to be taken in seriously. That should give people pause, or that, you know, that should cause them to critically reflect on their own, the conditions of their own speaking, which is just as important. You know, having a voice is, of course, important, but that's, one has to ask, like, what are the conditions that make it possible for me to speak, and do not make it possible for others to speak at all, much less heard, but speak at all, right? The employments and deployments of the phrase, the hashtag Me Too, the fact that there are those who feel excluded by that, I think means that there's work to be done by those who identify with the movement. Those who feel excluded are picking up on something, and the responsibility falls on those who do identify and don't feel excluded to ask, well, why is it that there are those who are feeling excluded? What are they picking up on? I teach as part of my profession, and there are things that I think are going on in the classroom, and then, you know, at the end of the semester or different points in the semester, I find out that students had a whole different idea of what was going on. Not all of them, but every once in a while, there's one who thought I was doing something else other than what I thought I was doing, or I was saying something else, right? Even if it doesn't match up, or often doesn't match up with what I thought I was doing, and especially my intentions, if I'm being responsible, I have to ask, well, what was it that I was doing or saying that maybe made it possible for that person to hear it that way or to perceive it that way? And it doesn't mean that the other person wasn't necessarily wrong, like they could have heard it incorrectly or something, but there must have been something that I also was doing to participate in it being heard a certain way or experience a certain way. I think that's important work that has to be done when you're trying to take in the claims of others.
I think that's where feminism has to do a better job. We're still caught up because women don't have equality, and even the way we talk about them, it's a woman's issue, but it's not. It's a human issue. It's something that different groups experience, and we actively discount male victims, non-binary victims, queer victims. We don't give them a space to acknowledge what's happened to them, give voice to their experiences, and pull them into the movement and understand how their assaults are different in some ways. We lose all of that nuance when we call it a woman's issue.
I mean, I think having a voice essentially means like using your social power, if you have it, to speak out against things that you know are wrong. And I mean privilege when I say social power. So if somebody's of a privileged group, using their voice to help out a less privileged group, but also not talking when that less privileged group is talking, right? I think that it's really important to know when to use your voice and when to allow somebody else to use their voice and amplify their voice. Being relentless in that is one way to make sure that your voice is heard.
If we want to embrace feminism and we want to make a change, then that requires all voices at the table and everyone who has experienced the really problematic effects of living in a white supremacist patriarchy. If we want to understand all these nuanced differences, then we need to understand nuanced experiences. And no two experiences look the same. The effects aren't the same. It manifests differently. And we need those voices. We shouldn't be marginalizing those voices. Otherwise, we're no different. We also then focus on the victim, and we discount the fact that it's not really a woman's issue, it's the perpetrator's issue, and it's a cultural issue, and it's a human rights issue. We lose all of that when we render certain groups of victims invisible, and I think that's where we have to do a lot more work and be a lot more concerted in our efforts to be inclusive. I understand why that wasn't the focus maybe initially, but the idea about intersectionality has been around long enough that we need to do a better job now. And we need to be far more inclusive and acknowledging that our current power structure harms other groups than just women.
While considering the power of anti-rape digital activism on social media, another important aspect to consider is just how many people use and are exposed to the information on these platforms every single day.
It allows us to speak to more people all at once. Now it's like I tweet something and then however many followers I have, that many people see it immediately. That's totally new. That would be like, you know, me going downtown on King Street and using like, you know, a microphone and being like, crunchy peanut butter is the best. Hashtag I like Jif. You know, that would be weird to do, but to tweet that, totally normal. I get like 20 likes on that, you know?
If the goal is to bring awareness about how pervasive sexual harassment and sexual assault are, then I think it has helped that.
That Me Too movement, the hashtag Me Too movement, really spread awareness to say like, this is how many people. And I think that was really helpful for people who are not a part of maybe the movement or who are not a part of agencies like OASIS or not in our sphere.
It can provide this great platform of bringing awareness to our everyday actions and sometimes just plant the seed in ways that's different from conversations.
Especially, I noticed a lot of my male identifying friends and family members were really shocked by just this outpouring of who has been victimized or who has been affected. So I think that it spread a lot of awareness about just the incredible range of sexual violence.
I think when you are a member of a privileged group and you've never had to think about the fact that you walk down the street, it can be nighttime, you aren't afraid. I think sometimes you truly don't realize how something you say can be perceived. People don't think about how the phrase he said, she said privileges men and offenders in that situation. They don't think about that they're automatically discounting the veracity of what a woman is saying. When I do an exercise in class about all the things that women are socialized to do on a daily basis to reduce the risk of being assaulted, I literally see men's faces change because they've never thought about it. They've never talked to women about what they do to prevent or to lower the risk of being assaulted.
This type of awareness becomes possible when more and more people feel comfortable using social media to share their experiences and beliefs. This kind of comfort comes from sitting behind the safety of a screen.
I think there's also something that, again, is both positive and negative about being able to say things in text that you may never be able to say to somebody's face. I think it allows you to be vulnerable in a way to share your experiences without having to see someone's reaction, right? And you can compose it however you want. And if tears are streaming down your face when you compose it, that's okay because people can't see that. Or you can be really angry and punch a pillow in between typing different lines of your text. There is a certain level of perceived privacy on social media. So even though I think we understand that lots of people can see our posts beyond those who either follow us or those who we're friends with or whatever the medium is, there's still this perception of anonymity and privacy, like it's a safe space somehow. It provides a level of courage, which sometimes is quite remarkable, especially in terms of like giving voice to something that you may not have ever given voice to if it was a face-to-face conversation. I also think sometimes that gives people license in their responses to comment in ways that they may not realize is incredibly harmful and lasting.
I also think that it gives way to people, you know, using their voice in negative ways.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, right? There's the positive in terms of validation, but people can also be particularly nasty and mean and cruel in ways on social media that they would not engage in face-to-face because you're not seeing someone. You're not viewing the person. There's a dehumanizing quality to social media. There's a lot of harmful comments that are part of these threads when people disclose. There's still a lot of victim blaming. There's a lot of, well, you should just get over it, not understanding how trauma affects you for the rest of your life, right? I mean, in a similar way that we do this to combat veterans. They come back, we expect them just to get over it and move on because we can't see the wounds that they still experience every day. And I think we do the same things to people who experience sexual assault and sexual harassment. We don't see their wounds, and so we expect that everything is okay and they should just move on and get over it. And that's not how trauma works.
There are people who are using social media for the exact opposite reason, to spew hate and to find people who agree with that and to form little online communities of people who don't believe survivors and who genuinely believe that, you know, that rape doesn't happen or that, you know, people are asking for it when it does.
In addition to this dehumanizing effect of social media that allows for the posting of negative content, comes the ability to choose what you engage with and what you actually listen to.
Along with this idea of having a voice is, of course, the idea of whether there are those who listen. What listening means is, at least in terms of the work that I do, listening means actually having your subjectivity affected by the other in such a way that your subjectivity gets called into slight question. I'm not talking about like a profound breaking down of your sense of self, but that your sense of self is at least challenged and that you have to rethink the confidence that you might have in your sense of self. You're really allowing yourself the possibility to be changed, for yourself to be affected in that way, to be something other than what it was before you came into this exchange. I don't know that listening takes place in social media. I would say that listening takes place very seldom, if ever.
Everything that's so divisive in our society right now, it's because we're unwilling to listen to each other, and we make a lot of assumptions about how we have different viewpoints. And I think it's like on a grander scale, but also with conversations around rape culture and the Me Too movement, it's running us into the ground. And I think we're better than that. And I think we probably have a lot more similarities. We probably share a lot more confusion and struggle than we think. But we're not going to know that if we continue to make assumptions about one another and what we think each other thinks and what we think each other's experiences are. If we don't have the conversations, we'll never know.
Social media almost rewards just very quick reaction and dismissal. It's very much an adolescent space. Like, we just like things or dislike things. So, and that's all we did as teenagers. Like, you know, meh, I don't like it or whatever. Everything is stupid, right? And that's very easy to do.
While social media gives us the opportunity to learn a lot about what other people are saying, it also gives us the opportunity to shut everybody else out except for the people who 100% agree with us or who we agree with. We create this little like safe space, safe little vacuum for ourselves. One thing that I am very aware of with my own social media feed is that I exist in a vacuum, basically, of my own thoughts and my own values. You know, it's so easy if somebody tweets something that I do not agree with to unfollow them.
Social media has been criticized as a space where people can just flock to their own groups and it becomes this echo chamber where they just say things to the preaching to the choir, as it were. So all the incels can gather together on Reddit or wherever and they can just say things that would encourage each other and so on. They don't ever have to leave that air of that group. And the same thing for those who are anti-sexist, anti-racist, and we can just say things to convince ourselves that we're right.
you know, there's a difference between just like taking in information and being hands-off or passive and just allowing things to like come to you and then actively seeking it out or learning from it or making a behavior change or taking in information from somebody and then doing something about it, right? Yeah, you can, you know, listen to somebody speak all day long, but, you know, hearing them and making a change within yourself or within society or maybe even just validating that person is different.
I can refer to the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings where, well, you know, Dr. Ford spoke, so why are you complaining about, right? That's the response. And everyone heard her, right? But no one was really listening. And so that's an important distinction. Like, having a voice doesn't mean anything if there is no one actually listening. And if that listening doesn't result in something that brings about some kind of change in what the complaint is about. You see this in the Black Lives Matter movement as well, where people responded, well, all lives matter, right? That shows that no one was listening to that claim. The complaint itself, Black Lives Matter, carries with it this claim that they feel the ones issuing this proclamation, they feel that Black lives don't matter, right? And so the question is, well, why do they feel that? What actually like conditions that response? Part of the analytic experience is not only listening to others, but being able to listen to yourself and to understand like what is it that conditions your speech. We don't carve out a space for people to do that. Everything is accelerated. Education, everything is accelerated. So we actually don't carve out a space for that to happen.
One of the biggest benefits of engaging in any kind of digital activism is its accessibility. With over 80% of American adults actively using a smartphone, nearly 70% on Facebook, and close to 75% of young adults on Instagram, digital activism becomes a safer, low-stakes way to engage when acts of traditional activism are not available.
With online activism, people can engage in causes and issues in a pretty low-stakes way, which means that, you know, they can like a picture, they can reshare a picture, and they can, you know, learn from it. It can be incredibly intimidating to walk in the doors of Oasis and identify yourself as a victim. That's hard. I mean, a lot of work has to be done before you can make that first move. But perhaps, you know, if you see something that we post that talks about, hey, this is what a healthy relationship looks like, you can see that and think, that's not what I'm in. And it kind of gets your brain thinking and you're able to like start thinking about your own relationship and am I in a healthy relationship? Am I in an abusive relationship? Should I reach out to Oasis? It means that people are engaging with us without having to start out by coming to our events or start out by volunteering or things like that. It's important to provide educational opportunities and information for people in our community who may not be ready or willing to identify themselves as a victim or who may not be ready or willing to seek help or support. That digital presence is really helpful. Our end goal is to end, you know, domestic and sexual violence. It's not just to serve survivors, it's actually to end it. And so the way we're going to do that is through education and outreach and awareness and things like that. Online activism can be really powerful, but that doesn't mean that they're following up in real life. And I think that a lot of people are guilty of that. It requires that follow through and not just being passive.
Social media can be considered as providing an opportunity to have a voice, right? But I don't know how much my tweets constitute a voice, right?
There are so many people who, especially on our Instagram or even on Facebook sometimes, that engage with us really frequently. You know, there are a couple of people who, like, I know their handle. You know, I'm like, oh, that's them liking our stuff. But I'm not sure if I've ever seen them in real life at our event, or I've never seen them, you know, make a donation. And that, to me, is a con of online activism. It gives us that feel-good vibe that actually engaging with a person does, or actually volunteering or donating or learning. It gives us that feeling without any real follow-up.
Although digital activism might be more accessible for a lot of people, studies have shown that digital activism actually threatens the desire or need for someone to participate in traditional activism, such as donating, volunteering, or protesting. This raises the question, exactly how impactful can digital activism be when it is driving people away from doing the actual work?
The limitations of Me Too is that it's simply that. It's a hashtag, and it takes the place of actually thinking about something or actually investigating something. It takes the place of actual reflection. So that's a drawback of any kind of popular slogan where all you have to say is Me Too, and then the work is done. Like, that's the implication. The idea that one could, or that we could just simply keep proliferating social media with Me Too announcements as if to just point out the preponderance of experiences. I think that's just the beginning. Like, that designates the work to be done. That is not the work. If I respond to a white supremacist or a sexist on Twitter or something like that and think that I've actually done something, that's a failed idea of actually intervening in the public sphere. So we have to ask, like, if this is the public sphere, what kind of public is being formed in this public sphere? It's not that the public exists outside of these spaces of interaction. The public gets formed within these spaces. So what we have is a public that is content with simply exchanging quick bits of information or snarking at each other or trolling each other on social media. So what we have is all this energy directed at what I would say are these kinds of distractions to the work that needs to be done.
The Me Too movement, you know, the hashtag Me Too on Twitter started as a response to the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. And we know what happened this week. You know, he was found guilty of rape and sexual assault. So I don't think that is directly coming from the hashtag Me Too movement, but I really think that it did something. I mean, it sparked something in so many survivors to come forward because they felt like they weren't alone. They felt empowered. They felt like their voice was being amplified by people online. But even that, though, with this example, requires follow-up in real life.
The drawback is, and I think I was alluding to this when I said, if we think that just saying Me Too or using the hashtag does work just by itself or does all the work that we think it should do, I think that would be unfortunate because simply raising awareness is not something that I think really works, if I'm going to be quite blunt about it. As we saw with the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony to the U.S. Senate, no one doubted what she said. Even Republicans didn't doubt what she said. They said that she seemed reliable. Even Trump, of all people, said that she seemed reliable. Even though everyone said that they believed what Blasey Ford was saying, they still didn't believe it, right? So there's a way in which, you know, you can bring something to awareness. Everyone knows about something and nothing changes, right? So it's not about making things visible all the time, or I should say that can't be the final goal.
Online activism is great as long as you're also following up in real life and doing the things and, you know, supporting the causes and going to the events or making donations or volunteering your time or making life changes for yourself if you see a bad part of yourself amplified through online activism.
Ultimately, to answer the question, exactly how powerful can anti-rape digital activism be? Well, it's complicated. From my research, it seems that there are just as many benefits as there are disadvantages. It seems that anti-rape digital activism can be helpful, but we must work to make it more inclusive and not let it deter us from doing the real work. I believe that both anti-rape digital and traditional activism have their place, but when used together, that is when we have a chance of resisting and changing the cultural narrative. A big part of that, as Dr. Page says, is having the hard conversations.
Well, I would love to have rape culture diminished. I would love it if we promote human rights. When you see people as equals, when you don't view an entire group of people as only having worth in their bodies and their sexuality, and you see them as whole three-dimensional people, then it automatically shifts rape culture. What I want to see in the movement is men make a concerted effort to be part of the conversation, to talk about how toxic forms of masculinity are problematic and limiting, and they don't feel good for them either, right? I feel like that's kind of, it's a missing voice in the movement. And I think they have every right to be part of the movement, to talk about the challenges that they face, the pressures that they face, how it's difficult to, yes, there's a lot of rhetoric about healthy manhood, but on a day-to-day basis in elementary school, middle school, high school, college, other scenarios, blue collar work, like how does that actually play out? How are all those efforts for an individual to navigate that space made more difficult by other people? And I don't mean other men, I mean women in that space. I think women perpetuate a lot of this in similar ways to men. We're all raised in the same society, so we're all subject to these viewpoints. We need to have very real conversations about how is this difficult? How do we navigate it? How do we accept the fact that just because someone wants to have a physique that's more muscular doesn't mean that person also engages in toxic masculinity? Like, we also have to break out of a lot of our stereotypes. It's that we need more nuanced conversations. That's what I hope. And that we welcome everyone to the table with those experiences and those challenges.
I think that we could work to make ourselves more aware and to try to encourage others to make the spaces that we inhabit together more inclusive, make people feel at home. Like, you know where, when you belong somewhere, you know when you feel like these are your people, this is your space, you know that. And even if it's not your people, you know that you can still work together. Like, making spaces like that, where one doesn't feel threatened and one doesn't feel the need to have one's defenses up. I think we could all work on that in different ways, and that's necessary.
I think we get very focused in how do we talk about sex and how do we have these healthy consent conversations and healthy relationships, and that's absolutely part of it. But you can't have those conversations in the absence of having a more equity-based society.
So I think that equity, you know, in this field looks like believing women, right? Believing survivors. I think that it looks like believing male survivors and tearing down this idea that if somebody who identifies as male was victimized, then they're less of a man. So kind of tearing down some ideas and amplifying the voices of the people who are marginalized or historically have less privilege, kind of walking with them through that.
It means we recognize differences, we value those differences, not diminish those differences. Until we do that, we will never approach ending rape culture or having a rape-free society. I think social media has a place in the sense of it can give voice to experiences, it can bring awareness, but it's no substitute for face-to-face conversations.
Social media is such a thing. It's a great thing, it's a hard thing, and it's so many things. So many different good things and bad things and opportunities and disadvantages.
Oh, I think it's so incredibly powerful for good and bad. It's very much a double-edged sword.
Social media has no power unless if we use it. So it really depends, I believe, on who's using it and for why, what purpose. It's really hard to say how is social media going to impact it, because it comes down to how are we going to impact social media. If used correctly, I think social media could be a really wonderful influence in ending rape culture and in our ability as a culture to kind of move away from that.
I think Me Too has had kind of mixed results. I think people understand now the pervasiveness of sexual harassment and sexual assault.
Thanks, social media.
But it's also led to a lot of discounting and a lot of shutting down of conversation. I think if we shut people down, then they don't understand the meaning and the experience and how it genuinely makes people feel when certain comments are made, that they aren't taken as compliments, even if that's how they're intended. And if we want real culture shift, then we have to be willing to have those conversations, and we have to be willing to have a certain degree of compassion to meet someone where they are and understand that part of that might be on us to explain how it makes us feel. if we're too quick to judge and not allow space for conversation and growth, then in some ways we're guilty of similar acts. Not sexual violence, but we're stymieing growth and we're making it where people are afraid to ask questions.
It's hard to say because sometimes I'm really optimistic and I'm like, you know what? Social media is great. You know, the youth will save us all. There are, you know, really young people who have always had this, you know, online presence or this social media presence. And I think they have this really cool, unique opportunity again to learn and to educate. And, you know, if used wisely, change the world. We can use, you know, movements like hashtag Me Too, and we can use these platforms, you know, to continue to amplify people's voices.
We live in a world where we need more compassion. We need more face-to-face interaction at this point. Social media has its place, and it's no substitute for building empathy, building understanding of experience, building compassion, meeting people where they are. It's just no substitute for that. It has a role, but it's not going to be the reason that rape culture ends.
I don't see rape culture as necessarily disappearing. We can't expect these things to just change or to evolve on their own as if they're some kind of a habitat or ecology just on its own, you know. So I don't see the structure of American culture, of Western culture changing in its foundational sense. As long as we still have a society that relies on capitalism, we will have sexism and racism and ableism and all these forms of discrimination and exclusion that capitalism relies on in order for it to continue to exist.
How do we then parlay this into policy reform? How do we parlay this into providing services for victims and for offenders? How do we change the perception culturally? How do we alter our laws to reflect this new conversation? Right now, we don't have any definite answers. So I think we have to also be okay with that there aren't any answers right now. There's a lot of questions, and there are a lot of theories and hypotheses about what might make it better. But we have to be willing to sort of renegotiate those hypotheses, and we have to have the hard conversations.
There are no right answers right now. And part of my argument is that more research needs to be done. What tools can we use to reframe the Me Too movement to welcome and include all survivors of sexual violence, not just cisgender white women? If users of social media are able to choose what content they see and easily tune out or not listen to the beliefs differing theirs, at what point does the empowerment of voicing your experience on social media outweigh the fact that perhaps no one is hearing you? In what ways can we promote the accessibility and relative safety of digital activism without discouraging a user's interest in contributing to the very important real work of traditional activism? If anything, my research has left us with more questions than answers, as Dr. Page says. What I have demonstrated is only the beginning. But as Black feminist scholar Bell Hooks writes in her 1989 book called Talking Back, Thinking Feminist, Thinking Black, quote, "When we dare to speak in a liberatory voice, we threaten even those who may initially claim to want our words. In the act of overcoming our fear of speech, of being seen as threatening, in the process of learning to speak as subjects, we participate in the global struggle to end domination. When we end our silence, when we speak in a liberated voice, our words connect us with anyone, anywhere, who lives in silence." I believe this is especially true now that anti-rape activism has created such a large digital presence. Since the conclusion of these interviews, COVID-19 has taken the world by storm, forcing almost all of us into quarantine. As I have sat in my small Boone apartment, writing this research paper and producing this podcast, anti-rape digital activists have not stopped fighting for a better world. It is when we are silent that nothing is being done. So I say, find the questions that need to be asked. Have the conversations that need to be had. Search for the answers, even if it seems like you'll never find any. But don't stay silent. Even if some people aren't listening, we will never be heard if we don't use our voices.
I feel like I want to say, like, go human rights.
And it's using our voices that will allow us to say it louder for the people in the back.